LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we were in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza. We've got a big show for you today, including an interview with a topic we don't often talk about, foreign policy and liberty, regarding our war in Afghanistan, if there is such a thing to talk about. All right, well, once again, we have gun control back in the news. You know, when I started writing about these things and caring about them, even before law school, I never thought, gee, the long distance topic to really involve oneself with is going to be gun control. We're still going to be fighting these battles 30 years later, but here we are. We talked before about David Chipman, and he is the ATF nominee, director nominee. So Joe Biden put him up for ATF director. He was with the agency for, I think, 25 years or thereabouts. And then when he left, he went and did a number of things, all in gun policy. And all of those things were denigrating the right to keep and bear arms. Basically, he was sort of in lockstep with the handgun control and assault weapons ban people. So I can't stand him just to look at him. He's got an S eating grin, as we say, and there's just something about the person that irks me beyond the fact that he has insulted the people who he is going to be in charge of monitoring and regulating if he gets this job. And it's one thing to have somebody who is perhaps cautious or skeptical of an enhanced right to keep and bear arms, but Mr. Chipman, his position is that what's clearly established by the Supreme Court as our right is basically too generous, and we need to dial that back. And it yielded, I think, I don't ever recall seeing this. It's a standalone commercial. I think we've seen it for, I know we've seen it for Supreme Court type stuff, but I don't remember for an agency head. So David Chipman nominated to be the ATF director. It's stalled in committee. The Democrats don't have the votes. It's a tied Senate. You have to get 51. And basically, they've got 48 Democrat senators and two independents. And they're not going to bring this nomination up until they can guarantee that they're going to get all their votes, because they're going to need all their votes, because he's radical enough that they can't even get Susan Collins or some half Republican to vote for this guy. But all right, they actually produced a commercial, an anti-Chipman commercial. Here we go.
Told The Hill that AR-15 should be treated, quote, just like machine guns.
They might think that they're diehard, ready to go, but unfortunately, they're more like Tiger King. And, only bring that out if the zombies start to appear. And I don't think they are.
And David Chipman, he's a special agent at the U.S. Bureau of Firearms and Explosives. David, thank you for joining us.
In a recent internet post on Reddit, he claimed that the Branch Davidians shot down helicopters during the Waco siege in 1993. No, they didn't. No.
So I just couldn't resist. I look forward to when all nominees to head agencies have campaign commercials for and against. Chipman is an interesting case too. This week, we learned that there is a case of racial bias being alleged against him. Chuck Grassley, I think it was, from the Senate Judiciary Committee sent a letter to the Justice Department asking for more documents regarding this personnel case, where when Chipman was at ATF, there's a black guy who says that Chipman accused him of cheating on an exam simply because he scored too high. And Chipman's comments were along the lines of, a black guy shouldn't be scoring that high as on the basis of their race. Now, it seems incendiary and unlike a 25-year career bureaucrat to come out with a statement like that, but that is, in any case, the allegation from Chuck Grassley. And it's funny when racism becomes the most toxic or damaging thing that a person can exhibit or can be accused of, it's no wonder that when there becomes a contest between people, we see allegations of racism when even, you know, there may not be anything there. So I don't know if there's anything there for Mr. Chipman. I think it's interesting, though, that now that the game has become not to get all Republicans to not vote for this person, that seems to be accomplished in the political sphere. Now it is, let's make sure that not all Democrats, including the two people who are independent who caucus with the Democrats, we need to get votes from that side of the aisle. Well, how do you take votes away from Chipman from the left? Well, a racism allegation seems like a great start. So they're well on their way to trying to scuttle his nomination. And one senator from Montana told a Washington newspaper this past week, when asked for comment after refusing to comment on the nomination, said, I don't even know if they're going to stay with that guy. So maybe the administration has sort of come to Jesus on it and realized they're not going to get any traction on Chipman and just either leave him as a directing or try to renominate somebody else. But in any case, I think so far it has been a win for the gun rights folks in the face of the NRA being hobbled by Wayne LaPierre's mismanagement and the reaction to it by Attorney General, New York Attorney General Letitia James. So I know we've talked about that before here. We have to probably give an update on where the latest is, but on their bankruptcy and reorganization. But without the NRA being able to operate at full capacity, they seem to be doing a good job scuttling Chipman's nomination. We'll see how much it matters. I think that the Supreme Court this term is going to really matter a lot more than Chipman, but we'll see. He's highly motivated and he knows where the levers of power are in that agency. So he could be a formidable enemy for gun rights advocates, and maybe his defeat will be a big win for them. All right. In addition to Chipman this week, we had a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dick Durbin, senator from Illinois, put forth the idea that his anti-straw purchase law is desperately needed and tied it to the murder of a Chicago police officer. Last week, a woman named Officer French was murdered when the facts seemed to suggest that she and her partner pulled over a car for either like expired tags or something simple like that. And during the course of the traffic stop, this guy got out and executed her, shot her in the head or face, and shot her partner too. She's dead. And Dick Durbin doesn't want to kind of get out of the, he wants to get in on the juice for the spotlight for what are we going to do about these killings? But of course, it's not what you might think, which is to more police, up armor the police, that they should be more cautious. It's about gun owners and adding a new federal crime for some gun owners for the way they get their guns.
And as heartbreaking as Officer French's death is, it is also infuriating. We learned yesterday from the Chicago U.S. Attorney's Office that the gun used to murder Officer French was straw purchased from a gun dealer in Indiana. What is a straw purchase? It happens when a person who can pass a background check buys a gun and gives it to a person who can't. Straw purchases have long been the way the guns have funneled into the hands of those with felony convictions in Chicago, then to the streets. than to deadly incidents. According to the charges filed yesterday by the U.S. attorney, an Indiana man bought the handgun from a dealer in Hammond, Indiana, gave it to a person with a felony conviction who allegedly used it this last weekend to kill Officer French. For years, I have been fighting to toughen our laws against straw purchases. Right now, straw purchasing is treated, listen to this, as a federal paperwork violation for lying on a federal gun purchase form. Charges are rarely brought, and when they are, the sentences are often just a matter of months. That needs to change. I've joined with Senator Leahy of Vermont, Senator Collins of Maine, to introduce the Stop Illegal Trafficking in Firearms Act.
Now, one thing you need to understand when you hear him talk about how it's just like a paperwork crime is the idea that if you accuse somebody of it or if you are being investigated of it, you don't have much to worry about because it's a paperwork crime. Well, that's absolutely not true. And no lawyer would ever give you that advice. And there are plenty of people in prison right now for, quote unquote, paperwork crimes. That's what they convicted Martha Stewart on. They convicted Bernie Madoff on that. And other famous people who've done time in federal prison, you know, that's like not reporting something that you need to report that you can go to prison for not doing so. It's easy to call it a paperwork crime, and it is. But that doesn't mean that the teeth aren't there. So what Dick Durbin hasn't established is that there are people who are doing these straw sales, and we know they're doing the straw sales, and yet somehow, because there's some malfunction in the law, that we're not able to prosecute them for doing so. That is nowhere present in the law. And that should be required, I think, for any new federal criminal law, and especially one in this area where politicians are just tempted to kind of pile on so that they can get their name in the headlines, like I think Dick Durbin is trying to do here. Officer French wasn't murdered because of some straw purchase. That's the mechanism by which her murderer got the firearm he used to kill her with. But he would have likely used some other mechanism if that straw purchase avenue was slightly more difficult or more costly. We don't have any data that suggests it would actually stop this kind of homicide. So, all right, let's turn our attention to international affairs. Somebody said that war is the health of the state. It's certainly the enemy of liberty, I think, for both people who prosecute war and for people or states upon whom war is waged. So I'm delighted that we're, if we really are going to not be at war in Afghanistan like we've been for 20 years, but did we do it in a way that was the least beneficial for the United States, or is it just time to cut and get out and say good riddance, which is what I tend to think. But I wanted to bring in somebody who actually is quite knowledgeable about the topic, and he is LibertyNation.com's, I think, most knowledgeable military affairs person, and he's going to shop it up with us, and we talk about the end of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. For his inaugural appearance on The Uprising, wow, can you hear that?
Yes.
That is some thunder. He brought the thunder. He's going to bring the thunder to The Uprising. J. David Patterson is our guest. Dave is a retired U.S. Air Force pilot and the former Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller. And he writes for LibertyNation.com and has written for The Federalist and others. But please go ahead and visit his work at LibertyNation.com. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be with you.
So I want to read... Wow, we've got the thunder coming here. I'm going to talk through it. Hopefully it's not too distracting. I want to read just a little brief thing that you wrote a couple weeks ago in the pages of LibertyNation.com regarding the Afghanistan situation. You said, any exit by American troops during continued fighting will have the stain of unfinished work and a precipitous retreat. One thinks of the iconic April 1975 AP photo by late Dutch photojournalist Hubert von S., showing South Vietnamese scrambling to get on the last chopper out of Saigon, departing from a hotel roof half a mile from U.S. Embassy. Could this be a harbinger of things to come in Kabul, Afghanistan? And as we look at the news, it looks like that's going to be a big fat yes, Dave. It looks like.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it appears as though that's the case. Right now, I just saw on Fox News that the embassy is shredding and burning classified information. And so that's always kind of an indicator that they're planning to get out of Dodge.
Is there, I didn't get the sense from your, so there's an an article that is yet to be posted on LibertyNation.com where you summarize the kind of very latest things. And you talk about how the missteps from this were born, I guess, in starting in May of this year or a little earlier when Biden announced the withdrawal. Can you tell me, is there a way that the same withdrawal could have been effectuated, but in a way that didn't result in the fall of Kabul? Because I guess with the way I come at the problem, Dave, is I'm one of these people who thinks that we should have never gone in there in the first place, perhaps, and that we should extricate ourselves as soon as possible to the extent that we can do so, you know, without upsetting the apple cart too much. Was there a better way to go about it?
I think that there was a better way for certain. And I see it in kind of two dimensions. First of all, the Biden administration could have understood back at the very first of May that the Taliban were starting their spring offensive. And incidentally, it shouldn't be a surprise because the weather's good and the Taliban always start a spring offensive. What surprised the Taliban, I think, at some level was the ease with which their offensive went forward very quickly. And I think that as former Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, Jack King, said that they knew that when President Biden gave a date certain for getting out of Afghanistan, that there were somewhere in the order of 7 bases that had to be closed, and that the focus of all of the personnel and the leadership was going to be on getting people out of those bases, and that takes a lot of effort, time, and focus, and consequently, the United States focus would not be on defending ground in the various provinces. The second thing I think is true is that the Biden administration could have continued with the very precision airstrikes to dissuade the Taliban from moving in. And we've got a lot of ordnance. The allies have a lot of ordnance and capability to rain down real death on the Taliban. And we should be doing it right now. We should never have stopped. And unfortunately, as the Air Force Times told us today, the number of airstrikes and the use of air power in support of Afghan has diminished significantly since the first of the year.
Make the argument for me, Dave. Why should we be doing it now if we've been doing it for decades now without much? Seems like traction to, I mean, here we are. We've spent untold dollars and ordnance and lives prosecuting this war. And it seems like we can't even get 100, like the perception from somebody like me is I'm looking at the news and it's like none of the Afghans even seem to be putting up any defense at all for Kandahar or for any of their cities in the face of, it's like they're just willing to welcome the Taliban in. You know, what are we fighting this for?
Well, that's a good, you know, that's a very good question. And I think that perception is a valid one. What has happened over the course of 20 years is that the Afghan security forces have become so dependent upon the United States and our air power to solve their ground problems that when the air power went away, they truly had no confidence in either themselves or their government to satisfy that air power dimension. The problem that we've always had when we give countries weapon systems and we give them fairly sophisticated aircraft is that we've not been able to convince them that maintaining those aircraft and sophisticated weapon system is all part of the deal. And so you combine the fact that their aircraft and their air force, which by all accounts is not an air force that's not capable, but their aircraft are not always in the best of shape. And when our contractors and when our maintenance personnel left, it became a struggle for them. And we see that now.
Do you think that if you went to various parts of Afghanistan and could communicate with those folks in their local language, according to their customs, do they believe that they are Afghanis? Is there an Afghani identity that they kind of hold?
Well,
or is it just that they're a member of a tribe who happens to live in this area that we call Afghanistan that's drawn on a map somewhere?
I think that the more, the stronger ties are with family, tribe, and local province chiefs. Those who live in Kabul, the capital, and some of the other larger cities, have a more focused view on who they belong to, and will tell you that they are part of the Afghan country. And but when push comes to shove, the people outside of Kabul will definitely revert to their tribe and family and province.
If you were commander in chief, what would your prescription for the area be? Would you stay there and prosecute the war the quote unquote the right way, or would you want to get out? What's best for America?
Yeah, I think those decisions have been foreclosed. I see that at this point, it would not be in anyone's interest, least of all ours, to accelerate any sort of ground combat. I do believe that it would be of value, just if nothing else than to send a message to the Taliban that we can still play whack-a-mole and to start a campaign of airstrikes. But there is a drawback. I mean, there's a problem with that, in that airstrikes generally are most effective when you have a ground controller, where you have somebody on the ground who identifies spots and lasers the target for laser-guided bombs and other weapon systems and ordnance that use laser guidance.
Yeah, that's a common sniper duty.
Mm-hmm.
Paint up those targets. So do you happen to know what any published figures are on these Taliban? What percentage of them are born and are from Afghanistan and are or those from somewhere else in the world that just want to go ahead and fight Americans?
Scott, I think what you're seeing now are mostly indigenous Afghans who are Taliban. And okay. Whose fathers were Taliban, whose uncles were Taliban, and they have just been waiting for the opportunity to be Taliban.
I remember when they were talking about dates to leave Afghanistan 5, 10, 15, even 20 years ago, and the kind of counter argument to that would always be, well, if you give a date, then you're just setting a date for them to know when to come back. But if you don't give the date, how can you effectuate the withdrawal of a complicated, you know, body of military organism like we have over there? It seems like it's a catch 22.
Well, I don't necessarily think that's true. I think that what you do is you create a very clear and unambiguous objective that is measured, and that you can understand and define what winning is. You know, Caspar Weinberger, if you can put your way back hat on, back in, I believe, 1981, when he gave his six conditions for going to war. One of them was to have a clear military objective. Unfortunately, with Afghanistan, our objectives were never that clear. And consequently, the idea that what we were going to do was going to bolster and fortify the Afghan government and the security forces.
Stability, right?
And gain stability, exactly. Now, that's an activity. That's not a military objective. And so consequently, it can go on forever. And there's no end game to it. You can say, well, you know, we've trained 90%, and that was our goal. Okay, so tomorrow there's another 100 people that come in, and now it's not 90% anymore.
Right.
You know, to be trained. And it is too also unfortunate that the culture in Afghanistan is one in which allegiance to a central government, although they might be happy to confess that they're Afghans and not part of a tribe, but nonetheless, you know, the allegiance to a central government is probably not as strong as we'd like.
Well, you know what, Dave, I have to say, there's something about that that kind of warms the cockles of my heart, that they don't have allegiance to a central government in a way that exhibits some sort of self-determination. All right, let me wrap up with a couple things here. Let me ask you this. I read from time to time about the involvement of the Pakistani intelligence service in the their goings on. Is this something that couldn't have, like, is this a, are they effectively a lesser agent of the Pakistani intelligence agency, or are we seeing their meddling, intolerable meddling by other countries, or how would you characterize it?
I think that the easiest way is that they live by the old rule, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And anybody who happens to agree with me at any one particular moment is my friend. And when they stop agreeing, then they're not. And that was the case with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban connection. As soon as Al-Qaeda became a pariah, Taliban unloaded them. The Pakistanis, particularly in Waziristan, are very cordial to the Taliban and have been fairly consistently. And many of the Taliban consider Pakistan their winter home. So,
okay. All right. Last question is, put your crystal ball out and let me know, looking backwards from 5 years from today, what do we see in that's happened in Afghanistan?
Are we looking 5 years in the future or
no back? what's going on? Like, just give me a situation. Do you think that, you know, okay, is it headed to a full,
you know,
is it,
five
is
years
it
ago,
be fully Islamic? You know, will right. that be the Taliban state in the sure. in the world?
5 years ago, you had Obama in the White House, and his approach to things was he thought that this was the war that should be fought, but didn't do it very well. And so as we were looking forward, we thought that the best you could do was to attempt to get the Taliban engaged, at least, if nothing else, in conversation. We tended to eschew the idea of setting time limits. Unfortunately, senior leadership often did that because it was easy. But getting some very clear goals and objectives that you could accomplish and say, these were the things we finished and we decided that when these were done, we were done. But that never happened, actually.
All right. Anything I should have asked but didn't?
No, I can't think of anything, Scott. I think you're pretty much on the mark here. And we're going to see in the next couple, 3 days and possibly a week if how this is all going to sort out. And hopefully they'll allow a peaceful withdrawal, despite the fact that any withdrawal is going to look like a surrender and a retreat.
Yeah, the other image that springs to my mind with respect to the Vietnam example is the video of them pushing the Huey off the ship because there's just no room for it, right? And more coming in.
And more coming in, exactly. Yeah.
So scary. We'll have a good thought for every American who's in peril over there. And I have to say that I'm looking forward to a time when we're not involved in Afghanistan actively as a foreign power. I've been really hoping for that day for a long time. So maybe something good can come of it.
Well, you're not alone. I think there are a lot of people who think so.
J. David Patterson, thanks so much for joining us. We'll keep up with your writings on this and other topics on the pages of LibertyNation.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Patterson. I looked it up. It's over $1 trillion now. That's what the websites that estimate this spending is. So if that's true, then it's probably close to $1.5 trillion. But in any case, I'm certainly happy to not spend any more of that in Afghanistan if we can. I don't quite understand why we spent so much to date, except that as I look around the fancier zip codes in the Washington, D.C. area, I think that's where a lot of the spending kind of gets rerouted to. So there's lots of voices to say spend and spend and spend, and there are a few voices for the people who say we need to stop spending all this money. Now, one of the few voices that is consistent with that, and I just have a couple of quick clips here before we go, is Rand Paul, who made some statements about vaccine resistance that we can't even get into unless we want to have this program pulled from our distribution partners, if you know what I mean. So we won't talk about that, but I will say this is the latest attempt at MSNBC to get Rand Paul somehow canceled on the basis of corruption. What's the corruption? Well, he bought a few thousand dollars of a pharmaceutical company before COVID hit the United States. That's the corruption. Don't believe me? Here we go.
Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has been so consistently pro-COVID, I don't know, you might think he had a financial interest in more people getting COVID. And it turns out, in a weird way, he kind of did. On Wednesday, Paul disclosed that he and his wife bought between $1,000 and $15,000 worth of stock in Gilead Sciences, the company that makes the antiviral drug known as remdesivir, which was tested to treat COVID. The purchase was made on February 26th of 2020, the day after the first US clinical trial on the drug began. This was around the time the virus was rampant in China, and there were only 15 US cases. Members of Congress were getting briefed on the dangers of COVID at the time, but it was before the public really understood the threat. Paul also disclosed the stock purchase 16 months after the deadline for senators to do so. Now, that could be a totally innocent mistake. A spokeswoman for Senator Paul said he completed the disclosure form last year and only recently learned it was not turned in. This stock purchase is not a typical move for the Paul family. CNBC reports the couple had not bought or sold stock in an individual company in at least 10 years when they made this particular purchase. Now, whether this deal was corrupt or not, we don't know.
Well, there you go. He did it all to make a few bucks on a stock that he didn't make any money on. And the last thing we have is a little bit of the left, the journalistic left, trying to push the ball for Merrick Garland. He's not indicting Trump people and Trump officials at the level he needs to be. Joy Reid on MSNBC had Eric Holder on the program. And you know what she did? She took the time to ask if maybe Merrick Garland was just being a little too lenient, not going hard in the paint against the Trump officials. Here's what she had to say to the former United States Attorney General.
Yeah, I certainly think that, you know, everybody who was involved in that matter, you can't cabinet and just think that January 6th is the only thing we need to be looking at. We've got to go back a couple of months. Everybody who was involved in that, I mean, everybody, should be investigated and then potentially prosecuted. Now, prosecution of a former president involves a whole range of things that, you know, goes that's a little different from, you know, people who served below him. There are national interest divisions that could unleash, which is not to say that he should not be held accountable if he is found to have committed criminal acts. But at a minimum, an investigation needs to be done to find out who exactly was involved. What was the connection between people in the White House and people who were there on January the 6th, through intermediaries or directly?
And you were there, obviously, when Merrick Garland was chosen to be on the Supreme Court by former President Obama. So I assume you know at least know a lot about him. Do you get the sense that he is overcautious in that regard when it comes to investigating the former president, members of Congress, and others who may have been complicit in what amounted to, what not what amounted to, in what was an attempted coup, an insurrection against the United States?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've known Merrick for, you know, maybe 20, 30, 20, 25 years at this point. I think he's a person who's going to do things, you know, by the book. I think he understands the.
Well, Eric Holder took his opportunity there to argue that we should really look into Trump and Republican administration officials even more deeply and even well before January 6th. I would just say that I'm still waiting for the report on the too fast, too furious, the guns that we sent south to Mexico, then lost sight of, and who ordered these guns to be given away to Mexican cartels. People say that it was Eric Holder. They stopped the release of the information that let us discover it. And where's that investigation? So maybe Merrick can finish up that one first before he gets to the January 6th. We've been waiting a long time to find out who in America said that we should give these criminals guns and then end up at the scene of the deaths of U.S. agents, including. All right. All right. That's it for this edition of The Uprising. We'll be back with you next week. In the interim, remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, the Rabbit Hole podcast, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to LibertyNation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit One Generation Away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.